This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
Area of medical ethics that I want us to take up is the question of genetic engineering. The term genetic engineering probably sets off a good number of internal alarms in all of us when we first hear it, due to the provocative labels that are used often in the mass media around us. We hear of test tube babies, and we have certain mental pictures evoked by these kind of labels. We will all remember the hideous past attempts to manipulate nature by eugenics. We think of the Hitlerian schemes and medical experimentation there. We have science fiction fantasies all around us that influence our thinking and imagination. And indeed, the very connotation of man engineering his fellow men like some kind of fiendish autocrat probably repulses us somewhat as well. And so the very title, genetic engineering, may set off those internal alarms. However, genetic engineering really covers two distinct types of experimentation, neither one of which should in themselves make us all that squeamish. Genetic engineering sometimes is a phrase used to talk about the external selection of genetic material. For instance, if you are engaged in artificial insemination, it might be considered a form of genetic engineering for you to go to a sperm bank and say, well, we're looking for an offspring that will have characteristics of dark hair and blue eyes and that sort of thing. That's one kind of genetic engineering, but that's rather mild in comparison to what we're going to be talking about, because that's external selection. Genetic engineering, for the most part, deals with internal correction or alteration of the genetic makeup of cells by substitution, for instance, through the techniques of gene splicing. And there are two forms of internal correction that you should know about. I'm not going to go into a lot of scientific detail in this lecture, but at least this much, you should know the difference between gene therapy and hereditary therapy. Gene therapy is the correction of the internal gene structure in a person for the sake of present situation or circumstances only, so that we might correct some genetic defect in a person, but that won't have any effect on his offspring or all the rest. Another form of genetic correction, though, would be considered hereditary therapy, where through gene splicing, it turns out that what a man or a woman will pass on to the next generation will be affected by the altered genes that have been brought about through the splicing technique. It's quite clear that there are certain amazing prospects that are presented to us in modern science, thoroughly amazing prospects as to what modern science can do through recombinant DNA therapy, gene splicing, and all the rest. The general question we will have to consider, though, is whether these amazing prospects in science amount to subduing of the created order and the alleviation of the curse of sin to the degree that would be approved by God, or whether this is in fact perverting the created order and advancing the curse that has been brought upon the human race because of its sin. Medical intervention can repair more and more defects in our genetic makeup, in our gene pool, if you will, and there is really a need for such cures. I'd like to quote in that regard page 52 of Anderson's book, J. N. D. Anderson's book, Issues of Life and Death, which I've asked you to read. Professor R. J. Berry insists the mortality due to a group of diseases with a high genetical component has increased from a negligible 2% to a substantial 25%. 6% of the population have a readily recognizable genetical defect at birth, and 25% of children admitted to hospital care are there because of some inherited anomaly. I don't know, that came as a surprise to me. It probably surprises many of you that the percentage of children that are bearing some kind of hereditary anomaly, of those children that have to go to a hospital, 25% of them will be genetic problems. And so there certainly is a need for the kind of scientific advance we're seeing around us, even though we may be a little bit worried as to whether that represents a subduing or a perverting of nature. the public attitude towards genetic engineering has changed from almost sheer fatalism, where the general outlook was nothing can be done about our offspring or our genetic makeup, to perhaps apprehension, just the opposite of fatalism, the apprehension that too much might be tried. There was once a time where it was almost like genetic roulette. That isn't to be disrespectful to Providence, but from the human standpoint, nothing you can do about it. You're always taking a risk, to the point now where perhaps scientists will attempt to do far too much. The amazing possibilities for genetic advances will be evaluated, obviously, in a different way from the standpoint of one's world and life view. Are we, through genetic engineering, furthering our own naturalistic evolution? Or, on the other hand, are we fulfilling in a new way the supernatural mandate to fill the earth and subdue it? And what light do you view these genetic advances? Obviously, the humanist is going to have the wrong perception or perspective from the very outset. But even if we begin with the right perspective, we need some detailed answers as to how acceptable what's going on might be. Are we moving from cooperative control over creation to manipulation of some people by other people through the genetic techniques that are available to us? Should there perhaps be limits to man's dominion? Again, quoting from Anderson's book, page 35, a surgeon, C.G. Scorer, writes, "Man's confidence in the possibilities of his own technological achievements is almost unlimited. There is nothing in this world he cannot do if he really sets himself to do it. As he literally reaches for the stars, as he increases his control over his environment, so he sets about securing his own destiny by remodeling himself. Medical progress has recently pushed open a new door. We have become fascinated by the possibilities of what we may soon be able to do with our own species. Curiosity beckons us. Politicians envision new possibilities of power. Surely along this way lies the solution to some of the world's most pressing problems. But can we be certain about this? Certain that we are not raising even greater problems than we are trying to solve? If God is creator and lord of this world, and of man in particular, are there limits which need to be set to man's dominion?" R. Rattery Taylor, in the 1969 book, The Biological Time Bomb, wrote, "The power to interfere in the process of heredity is the most serious of all the human problems raised by biological research." In one sense, the question of abortion, the question of artificial insemination, and questions of that nature are not even in the same ballpark with the explosiveness and the significance of questions having to do with genetic engineering. Now let's talk about certain aspects of genetic engineering that don't deal with gene splicing and such techniques, things that we'll want to include in our discussion. There is the whole question of artificial embryonization, the idea that a woman would contribute an embryo to another woman for the sake of her bearing of a child, just as a man might contribute semen to a couple so they could bear a child. In vitro fertilization, that is the fertilization of an ovum in a glass dish, in vitro meaning in glass in Latin, and test tube babies, which is the more popular media way of speaking of in vitro fertilization. Due to blocked or diseased fallopian tubes, some women would be tempted to use in vitro fertilization, where an egg is removed from their ovaries, a hypodermic needle being extended through the abdomen, and then fertilizing that egg outside of the body in a glass dish with her husband's semen or conceivably a donor's semen. And the embryo is then transferred back to the womb for a natural development. And indeed, one woman's embryo could be translated to the womb of another woman, artificial embryonization, for development and delivery. And women might be motivated to do this for convenience, in order to avoid a natural abortion, for the sake of sterile women, or even for the sake of a woman who's had a hysterectomy. I suppose the least honorable in the eyes of the general public is a woman who says, "I want a child, but I don't want the inconvenience of 9 months of bearing the child and the pain of the birth process, so I'll hire another woman to bear my child through artificial embryonization. I'll contribute the embryo, my husband will contribute the sperm, And then this other woman will simply be something of the nurturing ground for the development of this child. Of course, the morality of the overall technique must be greatly affected by motivation. Even if you approved of in vitro fertilization or artificial embryonization, you might have a judgmental attitude toward a particular instance or contemplated instance because you thought the motivation that is added to the technique was an improper one. But some people would go beyond the observation I've just made about motivation and suggest that selective human breeding is fundamentally degrading. It's not just that the motivation's wrong sometimes, like for the sake of convenience, but the whole idea of selective breeding of the human species is in itself a degrading of the human race. The answer to that that is often made, and I think it is a very good answer myself, is why should we assume that genetic roulette is essential to human dignity? Because you see, anybody who says you tamper with the genetic procedures, if you engineer this at all, therefore there's something degrading to human dignity, that person would have to assume that throwing it up for grabs from the creation standpoint, to all the created factors standpoint, throwing it up for grabs is somehow essential to human dignity. And I'm not sure what kind of positive argument you would even begin to develop for that outlook. Yes, sir.
When people say that it's possibly degrading, could you relate that to a possible suggestion that an artificial insemination or embryonization or whatever you would call it would be in a sense adultery because it could be the union of two seeds which are not considered being married?
Yes, some people have suggested that. However, that argument has been raised long ago with respect to artificial insemination and the same considerations that we would raise against the argument in terms of artificial insemination would be just as applicable here. Basically, artificial insemination is not adultery because it doesn't meet the biblical criteria of adultery, which would include copulation, infidelity, and lust. And since there is no copulation, no infidelity, presumably, and there is no lust, that it's not really a form of adultery.
So in the act of giving birth, you would be able to separate. It would seem to me that the biblical picture of giving birth is the whole, is a covenantal whole, so to speak, from copulation to birth. So you would say it is biblically legitimate to separate the sequence from copulation to birth?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Because as a matter of fact, the Bible is simply dealing with what was the known sequence there and doesn't say that known sequence must now be made permanent or enshrined in the dictates of law. That sequence just is the known sequence, and what is important is whether the sequence is performed with this person or that person. That adultery has to do with marital fidelity rather than biological naturalism of some sort. Well, genetics by choice also comes into the question here, not only artificial embryonization, in vitro fertilization, but the whole idea of genetics by choice, where we are able to eliminate defects or create clones and make use of sperm banks and all the rest. Of course, the whole idea of a sperm bank is the one that leads to the idea of selective breeding. We should remember at this point that it's not yet feasible or efficient to engage in selective breeding just because it is so complicated to understand the genetic techniques and the machinery, if you will, the technological aspects of how a woman with certain characteristics and a man with certain characteristics bring forth a child with a third set of characteristics. One is tempted to remember here Isadora Duncan approaching Bernard Shaw earlier in this century with the suggestion that they should bear children because wouldn't it be wonderful for a child to have her body and his mind. And Bernard Shaw replied, "Yes, madam, but what if perchance the child should have my body and your mind?" Which was something of a grand put-down of the lady. But that illustrates what I'm getting at, that it's just too complicated now for anybody to go in to a doctor and say, "Well, then we want a child with blonde hair and blue eyes and to be 5'11" and so forth. We just don't know enough about the interchange of the genetic material to guarantee success in selective breeding, although some people obviously are interested in getting the procedure started. People are trying to begin sperm banks in our day, yes.
If we did know enough about that, would that be good?
Well, we'll come to that. Let's ask ourselves that question in the course of this lecture, and if I don't get back to it, you remind me of it. Cloning is another possibility. I should at least say something about, there are a lot of jokes about cloning and the word is used, but very few people really understand what cloning is. Cloning is producing an organism by cell division and producing that organism by bypassing the sexual processes themselves. But you see, the sexual processes scramble genetic material, whereas in cloning, there is no sexual process, and so there is no scrambling. What you do essentially is produce identical twins by a nuclear transplantation, by destroying the nucleus in a particular egg or an ovum, and then putting into the place of the nucleus the genetic material that's been taken from the parent. Then what happens is that that organism develops according to all the characteristics of the parent whose genetic material has been put in the place of the nucleus. And so you produce an identical twin through nuclear transplantation. It amounts to, by the way, a virgin birth. Because what you do is you could take, theoretically, I'm not saying that the technique is developed as yet, but theoretically you could take a hangnail from a person. Let's say you had a woman who produces an egg in her normal monthly cycle. The scientist, the doctor, takes the egg, destroys the nucleus, the egg, and then takes genetic material, DNA material that can be found just in a hangnail from the woman, puts that into the egg. The egg would then begin cell division, would develop into a human being that looks identical, just like the mother. And that would be a virgin way to bring about a birth. And that has been done, by the way, with mice and frogs already. However, it does, most of the stuff I've read says, most of the material I've read says that this is not technically feasible now for humans and will not be for some time, just because of the difficulty of handling human genetic material and how small the human egg is and all the rest. So I don't want to say that next week we're going to face this problem, but I do dare say that we will face the problem eventually. Yes.
So are you saying that your complaint here is bypassing the sexual?
I'm not complaining at all. I'm only describing. Yeah, I'm not making any moral evaluation. I'm just trying to bring us up to date on what the facts of the matter are. Question.
Is the does the same rule apply to some of the techniques that they use now with, for instance, burn victims? They can take, instead of cutting off a whole section of someone's skin, they just take a little section.
That's right.
And then they make a hand or an arm, and then that arm of skin that has been produced in the laboratory through just a few cells of somebody's skin eventually grows back onto the person and goes into the life function.
That's right. That's one of, in fact, it's just within the last 2 months that the announcement's been made of the technique developed for natural skin grafting, or your own skin can be regrown in a burn situation. It's really, you know, we can't help as Christians but rejoice and respect the kinds of things that scientists are able to do, and that seems to be a very constructive matter. All sorts of threatening things accompany the potentialities as well, but that's one of the neat ones. Now, as we talk about eliminating defects in the hereditary genetic material we pass on, we talk about clones and sperm banks and all the rest, we should recognize that the whole science of eugenics, which basically means the improvement of the hereditary endowment of the race, eugenics fell into disrepute in the 1930s and 40s due to the racist overtones of eugenics. Quite clearly, with Hitler trying to create a super race, and all the rest, people came to disdain the very idea of eugenics and the name eugenics. But we need to ask ourselves whether that disdain, without the racist overtones and the autocratic setting or the tyrannical setting of a Hitlerian Germany, whether eugenics is in itself an evil thing. Let me just give you an example. Is the use of a sperm bank, which allows you the choice of the kind of germinal material that is going to go into the development of your child, is the use of a sperm bank anything more than the extension of a hereditary clinic? The counseling that you can get if you go to a hereditary clinic, the scientist says, well, now your children are going to possibly have the following defects or the following characteristics. I mean, by extrapolation, is the use of a sperm bank just the extension of such counsel? That if you say, well, no, you shouldn't have anything to say about the kind of children that are going to come from your marital union, well, then should you even go to a hereditary clinic where there, you might be counseled that perhaps you shouldn't have natural children because of mongoloid deficiency or something like that. If we believe that you can at least have some knowledge of the situation and control the situation through that counsel, should you not also have knowledge and control the situation through the use of a sperm bank? So the questions are being revived today about genetics by choice, and sperm banks, for instance, are forcing them upon us. What attitude should we as Christians take toward all of these possibilities? What should be our theonomic response? Well, the first thing that we need to say, and I think we must insist on, is that the church is to avoid a reactionary spirit. The church must avoid a reactionary spirit. Dr. Anderson, I think, has expressed this very well, page 37, when he says, "Our God is not a pagan deity who jealously guards the secrets of nature." Just remember that many pagan religions have gods that have just that kind of jealous motivation. They don't want other people to know or to have any kind of influence on nature, and so they jealously guard the secrets of nature. But our God is not such a pagan deity. Our God, in fact, has commanded man to have dominion, to be able to analyze the animals and to cultivate the garden and to understand the scientific biological processes. The cultural mandate is the very opposite of this Gnostic idea that the secrets are only for the gods and certain initiates. We need to avoid a reactionary spirit mindful of the very, very sad history of the church in this regard. And while the church may not be as bad as many humanists portray it, the church certainly does not have an acceptable history when it comes to scientific advance. There's very few major breakthroughs in science where there haven't been people in the name of the Lord, in the name of Jesus Christ, who have cried foul and danger and watch out and we must prohibit this because it's demonic or it's somehow evil or we're getting into areas God doesn't want us to know about. Let's remember also that if we're tempted toward a reactionary spirit, our scruples are not going to stop scientific development as such. They never have. If it's possible for something to be done in terms of scientific advance, somebody's going to do it. They may do it in the back alleys and in dark rooms and in secret. It may be underground experimentation out of the view of public scrutiny, but the fact is that if it's scientifically possible, there are going to be people who will pursue it. Only legislation could hinder the pursuit of these scientific possibilities to the degree that anything could hinder it. I mean, it isn't going to be enough for us simply to say, oh, it's terrible, and wring our hands. If we really think it's evil and immoral, then we're going to have some kind of legislation, or else it's going to be pursued. And I would add, even with legislation, it'll still be pursued. Might be pursued in another country, might be pursued in highly secretive labs, but it's going to be pursued. So except where we can demonstrate that genetic engineering is specifically immoral, we must be involved, I think, in genetic engineering as biblically guided restrainers on the activities of others and constructive appropriators of the kind of techniques and advances that are made possible. We must take advantage of the riches of the Egyptians, you see. Okay, we must avoid a reactionary spirit, but on the other hand, there are a number of reasons for caution when it comes to genetic engineering as well. A number of reasons for caution. If the use of human beings to test the efficiency and the side effects of new drugs is governed by strict regulations in the medical profession, then a fortiori, I'm just reasoning to the greater here, the avant-garde research which tinkers with the genetic future of the human race or its individual members must be approached with extreme caution. When the scientific world, the medical world, wants to try out a new drug, we believe that there are appropriate regulations in testing new drugs and testing their efficiency and side effects because we believe in the dignity of human beings. They shouldn't be subjected to undue risk. Well, if that's true in a very mild case, just the experimentation with a new form or strain of penicillin, then how much more should these avant-garde research techniques, which seem to threaten, well, maybe threaten is a prejudicial word, but seem to tinker with the genetic future of the human race, how much more should they be approached with extreme caution? We can't be reactionary, but we certainly can't run into this sort of thing just so enthusiastic that our eyes are closed. A great deal of caution is necessary. And caution is necessary in the first place because we may in fact be experimenting with human life. That is, the whole question is raised whether the scientist is not engaged in mass murder when he is playing games with genetic engineering in the laboratory. Remember that principle from Genesis 9:4 from my previous lecture laying down principles here. God tells Noah the life is in the blood, and therefore, while he can eat meat, he may not eat the blood. The blood is not to be eaten because man is not sovereign over life. God is. And if man is not sovereign over life, then man must, he's under moral obligation, to be cautious with fertilized embryos. He must be extremely cautious with fetuses, if you will. Because if our polemic against abortion, as I've presented and will present, I mean, in another lecture, is an accurate one, we believe that people, are human beings from the very moment of conception. A fertilized egg, an embryo, fertilized embryo, is a fetus, and we consider the fetus from the very moment of conception to be human. And so if the scientist is making use of fertilized embryos for experimental purposes in the laboratory, and then just discards them, that is, engages in the waste of fertilized embryos, he is in fact discarding human lives. Now I realize it's very hard emotionally to get into that mindset, because what you see in the glass dish down here doesn't look like a human being, doesn't act like a human being. But we have to be consistent with the premises that we use in other ethical argumentation and consistent with the premises presented to us from Scripture, and we have to say, therefore, that it is a human being. Paul Ramsey has very wisely spoken of a genetic duty that we have not to take risk with another person's life when serious defects are anticipated, or when we're simply going to discard that life as a matter of indifference. We have a genetic duty not to take risk with another person's life. So are we experimenting with life and engaging in murder is the first question. And secondly, we have questions about social consequences that have to be asked. Bernard Herring, in the 1972 book Medical Ethics, Herring, by the way, is a Roman Catholic who writes from Rome at the Pontifical Institute. In his book Medical Ethics, Herring says that each intervention into the natural biological processes which helps or enhances the, quote, wholeness of the human person, end of quote, is right. Indeed, it is a sacrosanct duty of man to engage in it. Each intervention into the natural biological processes which helps or enhances the wholeness of the human person is a sacrosanct duty. So that we are to become, what he says, are creative manipulators within the forces of nature, thereby even bringing man's true nature into being through such medical research. That we must engage in this research because we are, as creative manipulators, improving and bringing man's true nature into being. The task of deciding which particular interventions really do serve this advance, or which treatments are licit treatments for a particular patient, is one that he leaves open to scientific and political schemers, by the way. And that is very threatening. Not only do you see the Aristotelian metaphysic very clearly expressed in this Roman Catholic ethicist, he says we are really bringing about the perfection of human nature. We see this evolutionary development, teleological development of human nature. He says we are to engage in manipulation and intervention to bring about the wholeness of the human person. But the decision as to which techniques really do bring that about is a decision that we'll have to leave in the hands of politicians and scientists, which I think really should be a matter of great concern. Has God, as a matter of fact, made us the stewards of the human gene pool? Has God put into the hands of scientists and politicians the decision as to whether interventions are pursuing the wholeness of the human person, whatever that might mean, or not? should childbirth, this is a more practical rather than a social problem, should childbirth be completely isolated from the family context? After all, would society benefit from an overabundance of geniuses and virtuosos? If parents could choose the kind of child they're going to have, would society be better off by having a lot of Albert Einsteins and Rembrandts and Bachs and all the rest? Should we all? It seems to me these people have had enough problems in and of themselves. Would our society be helped by increasing that? And then, of course, there is the dreadful prospect, which we don't even like to think about, of creating a strain of powerful morons who engage in nothing more but menial or military tasks for the sake of their directors or manipulators. There's also the problem of imbalance and sexual differentiation. Let's say that everybody could choose to have a boy or a girl and was right within their control. And what if it so happens that our society favors girls today because of women's liberation, for instance? And we bring about in 30 years or in 20 years an imbalance because there have been so many girls born and not enough boys to go around. Are we, you see, wise enough? And are we morally mature enough to remake the human race, to proceed with technological progress apart from hearts that are committed to God's kingdom and glory? Well, I suppose I don't have to, in this audience, pursue very many illustrations to answer that rhetorical question. It wouldn't seem that we really are wise enough and morally mature enough to do these very things, and yet more and more, day by day, medical technology is putting within our hands the tools for doing these very things, and I'm not convinced at all that we are prepared to carry out our duties. There's a real ambiguity, isn't there? It falls to the Christian as to what his attitude should be. You've probably been waiting for some time now to say, okay, now, Professor, come down to the bottom line and say yes or say no on this question. But it's very difficult to do that. I've said you can't be reactionary, but you should be extremely cautious. There's a real ambiguity here, an ambiguity between compassion and caution. Consider the compassion that we should have as Christians. Note the good that can be done by genetic manipulation in relieving terrible suffering for humanity. After all, we do want healthy children to be born. We do want genetic defects eliminated. We do want them controlled to whatever degree they can be. So compassion calls out, engage in genetic engineering and research. On the other hand, caution is there too. Many people see genetic engineering as contrary to nature, as a menace to humanity, and as involving ethical questions beyond our competence to answer. On the one hand, we have compassion, on the other hand, caution. On the one hand, we have responsibility. God has told us we must subdue the earth. God forbids us to bury our talents. And so it's not just that we have compassion, but God will hold us accountable for our failure to do what we can do to pursue the ends of the cultural mandate. On the other hand, that responsibility is balanced by a respect for the individual, which sees the risk, the very real risk that are involved in manipulating human beings. Okay, well, all of those guarded remarks and all the yes and no that's involved in them, remember, we don't go beyond the guarded remarks so that we can forget them. The guarded remarks hopefully are going to hold us in healthy tension as we pursue such questions. I do want to go on and give a guideline, a more specific, definite answer about genetic engineering. And the perspective that I'm going to advance in this lecture is that a person's interest may not be subordinated without that person's consent to any interest outside of himself. A person's interest may not be subordinated without consent to any interest outside himself. I can give you some rather obvious illustrations. Let's say that it would be to the advantage of a general society and its view of law and order for us to take some man whom we know to be an innocent person but just something of a hermit in our society and try him on trumped up charges for being, say, the Hillside Strangler or the Atlanta Murderer or what have you, through the trial and the execution, thereby engender in society more confidence that things are under control. I mean, that would be subordinating his interest, without his consent, obviously, to interest outside of himself, to the society's interest at large, or the reputation of the police department, or something like that. We don't believe that we should go up to people on the street and rob them, you know, subordinate their interest to our interest without their consent. We shouldn't do things which are detrimental, take advantage of other people, unless people consent to that. I'm not even sure that all cases of consent are moral, but nevertheless, consent is certainly necessary, even if it's not sufficient, in cases where we're going to be inflicting some kind of threat or risk on a person. And I would say that my general principle, that a person's interest may not be subordinated without consent to any interest outside himself, that principle is especially relevant in cases of abstract research ends like, quote, the good of humanity, or, quote, the future of the human race, or, quote, the progress of medical science. If we don't believe that a person's interest should be subordinated without his consent, then especially abstract research goals like the good of humanity, utilitarianism, the future of the race, like survivalistic naturalists, or the progress of medical science, which is often a phrase that's on the lips of technicians and medical researchers, we shouldn't subordinate a person's interest to these ends without his consent. Now let's stop and think about what that means when the person talked about here now exists in a glass dish. Now again, I realize there's not a lot of public sympathy, psychologically speaking, for that, because it doesn't look like a person in a glass dish. But it is, theologically, morally, metaphysically, a person in a glass dish. Should that person in the glass dish, the fertilized ovum, should the interest of that person be subordinated to the needs of medical research or the good of the human race or the future of the human race? Should we experiment upon the fetus, knowing that in 14 days we're going to discard the fetus and 50 others in glass dishes in the same laboratory, knowing that even if a human life has been sacrificed, those 50 lives, it was worth sacrificing those 50 lives for the good of the 50 million people that will one day benefit from the genetic research that we're engaged in. And when I set the question out that way, I think the Christian answer or the Christian attitude toward genetic engineering in large measure is pretty well determined. You may not experiment upon a fetus in a dish without the fetus's consent. Of course, that's a little tongue-in-cheek. That's the principle fully stated. And then we have to add, of course, since fetuses can't give their consent, that you never can do that to a fetus. I repeat that. Never, under any circumstance, may you experiment upon another human life without that human life giving consent. Now, the response will be, well, the parents can give proxy consent for the unborn child in the same way that parents give proxy consent for minor children. Okay, if your child, say, cuts himself or has a terrible accident on his bicycle, and you take the child into a hospital, the hospital needs consent from the patient in order to perform an operation, which is true to my principle, a person's interest may not be subordinated without consent. However, in the case of minor children, we allow parents to give proxy consent. Now, if the parent can do that for a minor child and could do that for an infant, why couldn't the parent do that also for a fetus? Just extend the idea of consent backwards. Well, I would argue that the only reason we allow proxy consent in the first case is because it is for the good of the child, for the specific good, that is, the specific alleviation of some ailment, that the parents can give proxy consent. And therefore, if we understand our principles, it must be stated this way: there can be no proxy consent for an unborn child unless a procedure is directly intended for the alleviation of a known or very likely defect or disease. Okay? I can give consent for the hospital to perform an operation on my child's leg, and the only reason I can give that proxy consent is because I know it is specifically intended to alleviate the injury or the defect in the leg. Now, if there is some particular problem that is known about or that is very likely, and we're talking, obviously, in this world, We don't always have 100% infallible certainty about the facts of the world that give us the information on which we proceed to act. But if we have passed, you know, reasonable risk and all that, and it's extremely likely that there's a disease or if there's even a known defect in the fetus, the parents, I'm saying, could give proxy consent for scientists to work on that fetus if the work is for the sake of alleviating the defect or the disease or controlling it. And as part of the side benefit of that, we learn things about genetic engineering, alleviation of genetic defects, and that sort of thing. It seems to me that is the only context within which we could experiment upon an actual fetus when that experimentation offers, beyond unacceptable risk levels, offers hope of alleviating a known or very likely defect. Paul Ramsey, again the Princeton ethicist, has said that no experiment in genetic engineering should take place, for instance, introducing a virus to modify a defective gene in a fetus. No experiment should take place unless it is already known that there are no hazards at all. Now, I'm bringing up this illustration so you can see the contrast with the principle that I'm setting forth. Ramsey, I think, is being highly idealistic and very impractical here. Now, obviously, idealism and being unpractical when it's for the sake of godly ends is fine, but here it's not really being godly. It's going beyond God's restraints, I think, to say that there can be no hazards at all if we're going to do this. Because where in life can you proceed to do anything where there are no hazards at all? And I showed up for this lecture today, and I took some risk because it's possible there could be an earthquake. The earth would open up right here at the level of the podium, and I'd drop into the earth and die, whereas if I'd stayed in my room, that wouldn't have happened to me. And you say, well, that sure is a way out possibility, and it is a way out possibility, but it illustrates that there was some minimal risk. And Ramsey is saying there can be no risk at all, no hazards at all, if we're going to experiment with genetic engineering. And I say that by way of contrast. I'm not suggesting any impractical, idealistic, nearly inhuman requirement is that. It is beyond human beings to do anything where there's no hazard, no risk. But I do believe that you can pass a stage where the very likely risk or hazards have been minimized, and that for the specific alleviation of a defect in a fetus, you could do experimentation on the fetus with the hope that it will help that fetus, and what we learn from the procedure will help the treatment of others. Man, I'm suggesting, may manipulate nature and take reasonable risk. I mean, isn't that what's involved in saying that we aren't pure vitalists? God has given us a dominion mandate. We have the right to eat other animals, to control societies, some people controlling other people, to engage in certain forms of domination in this world, godly domination, domination that serves and guards the ends that God has set down for the human race and the dignity of the human race and develops nature as God wants it developed. Man may indeed manipulate nature, and he may take reasonable risk within the regulating boundaries of our biblical principles. Principle that man is God's image from conception, the principle that there is a family context for childbirth and care. Childbirth and care should never be solely a laboratory situation, and that there are lawful measures that should be taken to protect human life. Now, let me just tell you what the response has been to this approach, this particular lecture that I've presented in various places, and then I'll let you give your response. People who are very concerned for the threat to our social well-being that might be presented by genetic engineering usually don't like these remarks, and I would judge that that's a fairly reactionary spirit. Rather than being bold and assuming that good can overcome evil, that Christian influence can be dominant, and that Christians can appropriate these things for godly ends, they'd rather not get involved at all. On the other hand, people who are in the medical field or work for these laboratories that are engaging in gene splicing and so forth, they have tended to not like my remarks because these remarks would stop what is going on right now because they all know that they are doing experimentation with live fetuses and then discarding them after 14 days. In this country, HEW is now funding research into genetic engineering, in vitro fertilization, that sort of thing, with the provision that you're not to keep a fetus beyond 14 days, and that the fetus is only to be developed with the specific intent of re-implanting the fetus into the womb of the mother. Okay, now that latter perspective I appreciate, and that's one that we should demand, that if you're going to have an in vitro fertilized ovum, it should only be for the purpose of now putting that back in its natural environment for development, for its proper family context and end. We don't do that simply so that now we can do things in the dish and then throw it away. The idea that we should throw away the fetus before 14 days is supposedly guarding against the idea that you're finally going to get something that begins looking like a human being and then you're going to discard it. And besides, up to 14 days, there's some question about the viability and the attachment of fertilized embryo to the wall of the uterus anyway. Well, that, I think, is really questionable and a little bit distasteful as well, because, after all, this embryo is a human being. It's no longer an embryo. It's a fetus after its fertilization. It's a human being from conception, not just 14 days after conception. So I don't believe, as Christians, we can support the idea of experimentation for 14 days and then engage in all this embryo waste. And that raises other sorts of complicated questions. And I don't have time to go into all of them, but just so that I can begin you thinking and make you more curious. Is it moral for a scientist to receive more embryos than he knows that he can fertilize and put back into the mother? Should he collect embryos? Put a number of embryos in a glass dish, a number of discharges of semen with a high sperm count, so that at least in some way, one of those embryos might be fertilized, when he also knows that it's a scientific possibility that three or four will be fertilized. However, he doesn't have three or four wombs to put them back into. He only has one. Doesn't he put himself into a situation where he's opening the door to having multiple fetuses, and he's going to have to cast out three or four, a dozen of them? You see, the sort of caution that I'm bringing here, although it's not acceptable to reactionary Christians in our day and age, nevertheless, it should satisfy you from the standpoint of the golden mean, if nothing else, that it's certainly not very acceptable to the scientific community either, because it puts severe restraints on what is possible right now in terms of genetic experimentation. But what I want to say is we should be open to dominion, to scientific advance, and constructive appropriation of these techniques, but that openness is guarded by the restraints of biblical law. Respect for human dignity, the principle that the fetus is a human being from conception, and you can't take unacceptable risk without consent, and all the rest. Well, we're almost out of time. Do you have any remarks or questions you'd like to ask right now? Yes.
Were you going to go back to artificial embryonization?
Artificial embryonization, it seems to me, would be just as acceptable as in vitro fertilization. I've taken the extreme case, and it seems to me, given our approval, or at least what I see as approval of artificial insemination under guarded circumstances, artificial embryonization would be in a parallel circumstance. And now going beyond that, if we can even envision in vitro fertilization being approved in some cases, that artificial embryonization would be just as acceptable. Okay, well, okay, question.
Are you cloning? Are you opposed to cloning?
My hesitation about cloning is a hesitation having to do with the motivation for cloning. What good reason is there for it? Although I'm not saying that's an unanswerable question, I'm just saying that I'm having a hard time answering it. And then I have hesitation about developing a human life form that bypasses not so much the sexual procedure, that question had been asked earlier, but bypasses the centrality of the family, because cloning becomes basically a laboratory technique and, in fact, could be performed totally apart from parents who want the outcome of the clone procedure. Now, the response obviously is going to be, well, what if parents go into the laboratory, say, we really would like an identical twin of the father. Would you please take the ovum from the woman and take genetic material from the father and develop an identical twin? And at that point, my hesitation is the general hesitation about whether we are wise enough and morally mature enough to start restructuring the human race. And yet I've already said I don't believe in genetic roulette, so I'm kind of caught there.
How would you counsel a family who had their first child and it was deformed? They went to the doctor and the doctor said it's very likely that your next children will be deformed as well. How would you counsel them?
Okay, if a family has been told on good medical evidence, not just guesswork or statistics, with good medical evidence that their future children are going to be deformed, I would counsel them not to have natural children, to adopt or to engage in artificial insemination or embryonization.
Well, I know a family that pretty much happened to them. They've got three kids after that embryo.
Yeah. Well, of course, what those counterexamples point out is not that the counsel is wrong or unwise, simply points out that doctors at best know probabilities. My mother was told, just as a matter of fact, that after she bore me, if she bore any other children, that she would die in the process, or that it would have such damage to her that she would die before they were teenagers. Well, the doctor who told my mother that is now dead, and she's living just fine. Okay, so doctors make mistakes. I grant that. But we have to proceed on the best available information, and that's what our ethics council is dealing with right now. Okay, thank you.
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bonson, visit our website, bonsoninstitute.com, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.